Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio Free Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
I never really get over that... that promo. Hey, you know, we still have it every Saturday. If you miss it, don't. Here's that promo for Saturday.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour, every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Wyoming, drunk men came hurrying through. While Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy dew. Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
You notice how Carl gets his digs in? He gets his digs in on people who, I guess, traveled to Canada to avoid the draft. I don't know if he was drafted or not. He seems pretty bitter with other sections of the people. You know he's pissed off when he calls you a tanky. Tanky. That's, as in tank. Oh, survival isn't that thing to Carl. It's only...
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around, and then we found a man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is
born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Germany Well, talk about bad taste.
Something like that now, coming up the elections this November. And we've got the great orange one.
Come, let us rip down to the bar across the street. We don't want to be caught here during intermission. They'll stone
the producers at Great Broadway. Oh, great, great, great. Long-running Broadway. I wonder if it's still running on Broadway, the producers. Yeah, as I was saying before Zero Mostel interrupted me, at least the character he plays, we're coming up on the election this November, and by January 22nd or 20th, the inauguration day, I'm sure we're going to see a lot of action. There's going to be a lot of street action, bellowing, all kinds of stuff. Empty promises. And, of course, we've got old Genocide Joe. I mean, he's really... we're really... America's just stuck between a bimbo and an idiot. I mean, we've got two idiots. I guess the cliche is Tumble D and Toodle Dumb, something like that. I get it wrong. Well, we got to quit looking for gods. That's for damn sure. No one's going to lead us out of this mess. Really. I think the UN is probably the best, but unfortunately no one else in the world, at least in Israel or America, thinks the UN is something that we should do. And hell, they've even... UNRWA, that's a cliche, United Nations Relief Work Administration, the United States, we cut off funding, which is feeds the people and provides tents and things for the refugees fleeing from the outrageous attacks by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and it's a mess. It really is. It's a mess, and there's no end in sight. But I don't find any other international instrument to bring out the UN has done incredible work doing on the ground investigations and reporting for years, decades, on the plight of the Palestinian people. And a hat tip to them, you know. Hey, you know, here's the news, the latest news in brief.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Severe malnutrition in Gaza has soared to 15% from just 1% of the population before the war, according to the World Health Organization's chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. Briefing journalists in Geneva on Wednesday, Tedros said health facilities were struggling to stay open while health workers faced the risk of daily bombardment as they carry out their life-saving work. At the same time, he said the UN World Food Programme, WFP, is unable to safely access northern Gaza to deliver badly needed assistance. Tedros called on combatants to stop the bombing, reiterating the need for a ceasefire so that humanitarian aid can be delivered at scale. And turning to fighting in Sudan, Tedros said the country was witnessing a humanitarian catastrophe which has created the largest displacement crisis in the world. Over 6 million people have been displaced internally. WHO is scaling up efforts to respond to disease outbreaks and provide life-saving medical supplies, including in Darfur and Kordofan, he said. He stressed that if the world continues to turn a blind eye, many more will die. In the United States, the DuPont and Chemours chemical companies are dumping toxic so-called forever chemicals into the local environment, completely disregarding the rights and well-being of residents along the lower Cape Fear River in North Carolina. That's according to independent UN human rights experts who released a statement on Wednesday warning of the dangerous effects from the chemicals, commonly referred to as PFAs or polyfluoroalkyl substances, and said members of impacted communities have reported being denied access to clean and safe water for decades. PFAs come from products such as shampoo, nail polish, and the synthetic coating on carpets or fabrics. They're known as forever chemicals because they do not easily degrade in nature and can cause harm for decades or even centuries. Even though the companies are aware of the toxic impact of PFAs, they continue to discharge them, the experts said. They also raised alarm over exports of PFAs and hazardous waste from the Netherlands to the United States in apparent breach of international law. The experts said enforcement and remediation measures have been inadequate where legal action has been taken against the two companies. Health and environmental regulators in the US have fallen short in their duty to protect against business-related human rights abuses, they said. The UN Human Rights Council appointed independent experts have raised these concerns with the US government, which is yet to reply. And finally, Wednesday is International Mother Language Day, and Education, Science and Culture Agency UNESCO is calling on all countries to pursue a policy of multilingual education. That's because it's key to fighting the current global learning crisis, having produced positive results in the past. According to a recent agency study, children are more likely to start reading earlier when they're taught in their mother tongue during the earliest school years. Proof can be found across Africa. The continent has the world's highest linguistic diversity, but only one in five children are taught their mother tongue. To change that, Mozambique expanded bilingual learning to a quarter of its schools, and children are already performing around 15% better in basic reading and maths, UNESCO said. While people communicate in more than 6,700 languages across the world, 40% of them are threatened with extinction in the long term due to falling numbers of speakers. Matt Wells, UN News.
I don't know. I suppose we should encourage world languages. Day late and a dollar short. Here's one from a guy in Nebraska named Matt Grimm who had a band called Red Smear. And I don't agree with it, but he did it very facetiously. And I don't think his band's still around. I once heard from him a long, long time ago.
So you wear the best mental, you've gotten bigger things. Thankful by Beatles and dad by Christian Disney. You give us empty words and flashes out of town. But the rest of it don't seem to trickle down. Hopeless faces, mortgage and foreclosed. Downsells, a part-time job, forsaken by the HMOs. Sucking up the welfare when there's warnings of the day. Then they won't just go away if you miss me. Kill the poor, kill the poor. Put a cup right in their brain. Ain't no room, this utopia, for evidence it ain't. Arm the bases, arm the soccer moms, declare your holy war. The fall of a mink claim our inheritance, you'd better kill the poor. Ship out jobs to lands of deathless and despair. Purpose, livelihoods from Marin's pennies on the tier. They ask for more, refer them to the grain parades. There's always room for more in the mass graves. Repave our cities as consumerist plantations. Turn the cops into a martial force of occupation. All of America, those who can't afford the price. Kill the poor, kill the poor. Put a cap right in their brain. Ain't no room in this utopia for evidence it ain't. On the pages, on the soccer moms, declare you holy war. To follow me, claim our inheritance. You better kill the
sometimes only sarcasm survives fascism. You see, I think now it's gotten to a point now that you can have fascism, whether it's in Nebraska or, I'm sure he was playing at concerts where there was a lot of what they call skinheads at the punk rock concerts. I talked to him a long time ago, and he was had a band together, and he said it was difficult because there were so many fascist skinheads and in the Midwest. I mean, and it's easier. You can see them in the basements now. And I think this is pre-basement kid talk as today in the 21st century. Because now many fascist parents let their kids grow up. And the kids think, well, I can stay in the basement as long as I, you know, raise the American, the red, white, and blue. And tell mom that, you know, Trump is great or whatever concoction of like leadership is available to hypnotize the geriatric oldsters upstairs. If I tell them that, then they'll let me stay down here. I mean, it's really people, young people today are different now, and it's a very encouraging to see them take on the powers that be at their universities or in their in the streets. Everything. I've been very inspired since the Black Lives Matter movement developed out of Ferguson, Missouri, by the way, and successive waves of self-mobilization, largely of young people and a few oldsters like me, to get out there and stir up a ruckus and get people to think. I'm especially inspired by the resistance to the occupation of Palestine and the outrageous massacres being committed there in the last 4 months. So I think it's a great thing. Oh, by the way, coming up tomorrow,
for radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
Just like the news, just like the news from the United Nations, I mean, this literally comes off literally within a few hours after it's released. The same with Freedom from Religion or Free Thought Friday here at RFK. Free Thought Friday comes in, literally is just released it for broadcast on Thursday to terrestrial or, I don't know, real radio station, since we're not a real radio station, although you can call in. Area code 646-716-8652. Do not call anonymously or you'll be rigorously screened and probably not make it on the air. Call, just call. I'll keep your number private. The network doesn't release the phone numbers. They don't send out spam on you. Just call. Don't call anonymously, because every time people call anonymously, not every time, but almost 90% of the people who call anonymously are weirdos, crazy people, usually men, who want to get on air and talk dirty. I mean, I don't know if it attracts perverts or what, the Blog Talk Radio Network. I think they have some moderators in Brooklyn, but basically the corporation's owned out of San Antonio, Texas, and ran by what looks to be less than 30 people. I mean, it's just software. Ladies and gentlemen, it's just software. We get in under the curtain and play. I'm thankful. I've been doing it for years, since 2007. But Friday, tomorrow, the latest, the absolute latest in Free Thought Radio will be here. Saturday, the Abolitionist Hour, hosted by Carl. And Sunday, we have a great addition. I am really happy to play Siegfried out of Canadian. It's one station in Canada, a public radio, community radio station, plays back in the USSR, and I've got it on. Siegfried lets me play his show on Sundays back in the USSR. It's really a hit, by the way. I'm really happy to report. He does some great analysis and based on, and he cites his sources on Gaza in the last few weeks. He's been doing great stuff on Gaza. And he plays this really sort of neat music from cultural stuff from the Soviet era, the USSR, as people know it. Okay, well, without further ado, let's get on with the show. I'm glad you're tuned in. I'm your host, Mike Goodell, and I enjoy doing the show for you.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, a group of Palestinian plaintiffs brought a lawsuit in federal court in America charging the Biden administration with complicity in Israel's genocidal assaults in Gaza and the West Bank.
They came as close as possible to winning this case, and they stirred up thousands of people giving a voice to the Palestinians.
We're also going to discuss the parallels between the growth of fascism in Hitler's Germany and in Trump's America.
We speak with attorney and historian Benjamin Kiter Hetch on those parallels.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. Several months ago, various Palestinian human rights groups and individuals in Gaza and in the United States filed a lawsuit in a U.S. federal court against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin. Why? Well, for their failure to prevent and their complicity in the Israeli government's unfolding genocide against them, their families, and the 2.2 million Palestinians living in Gaza. They were represented by the attorneys at the famed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. Well, a week ago, after a hearing that included testimony from 7 Palestinian plaintiffs and witnesses as to the scale of the destruction in Gaza and its impact on them and on their families, the court found that Israel's assault and siege on the Palestinian people in Gaza did, and I quote, plausibly, close quote, constitute genocide. And the court implored the Biden administration to examine its unflagging support, they called it, for Israel. Now, this constituted a profoundly important finding, but the court nevertheless dismissed the case on the grounds that it lacked jurisdiction over the administrative conduct of foreign affairs, and that is a longstanding rule in U.S. courts. What was the testimony of the plaintiffs in this case? What were the legal arguments put forth by their attorneys? And why did the court rule as it did? And what is the significance of the judge's finding that it was plausible that genocide was indeed taking place in Gaza, and its urging of the Biden administration to examine what the judge termed its unflagging support for Israel in its war on the Palestinian people? Well, to help us understand these questions and more, we're fortunate to have as our guest today one of the lead attorneys in the case, attorney Catherine Gallagher. Ms. Gallagher is a senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Her areas of legal expertise include matters of torture and war crimes and militarism. Among her many, many cases of great note is the case entitled Situation of Afghanistan at the International Criminal Court, and the case entitled Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests versus the Vatican. Now, prior to her work at the Center for Constitutional Rights, she worked at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
Well, attorney
and she is
Catherine
also now
Gallagher,
a visiting
a very
professor
warm
of law
to the law
at the City University of New York.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Attorney Catherine Gallagher,
Catherine,
a very warm welcome to the Law and Disorder radio show.
Case that we're discussing today. Who are they? And as you do so, also tell us about their courtroom testimony.
Sure. So the case I'm discussing again today is Defense for Children International Palestine against Joe Biden, President of the United States, as well as Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin. And this case was brought back on November 13th by two Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine and Al-Haq, which is the oldest Palestinian human rights organization in Palestine, as well as three Palestinians who are currently in Gaza, including Dr. Omar El-Najjar, who was amazingly and powerfully able to testify from Gaza at the hearing we had on January 26th in Oakland. So he was able to testify. And then we have five Palestinian Americans who are all plaintiffs in this case. And each of the Palestinian Americans has family in Gaza and has close connections to Gaza. So they filed this case on their own behalf for the harms and the just horror that they've been enduring as they wait to hear the fate of their loved ones in Gaza and try and connect over these many, many months as their government, as the United States government, continues to send weapons to Israel, which, as Leila El-Haddad, one of the plaintiffs, said during her testimony on January 26th, that it's literally her family in Gaza is being killed with the weapons that her taxpayer dollars are going to buy. So it is five Palestinian Americans also as plaintiffs in this case, and we were able to hear them testify at a truly remarkable, historic, unprecedented hearing on January 26th in Oakland, California, in the Northern District of California court before Judge Jeffrey White on why we were arguing this case should be able to proceed, a case that is challenging the failure of the Biden administration in the form of these three senior U.S. officials to wholly fail in their legal obligation to prevent the unfolding genocide in Gaza and instead to be violating one of the most cardinal principles of international law, and that is that you should not be complicit in a genocide being the intent to destroy a people because of who they are, their nationality, their ethnicity, their racial identity, that Israel is actively at this moment, as the International Court of Justice ruled and as ultimately in this hearing the judge found, there is a plausible case of genocide. So that's, I put a lot out there on the table, and we can follow up maybe on some of the specific threats.
Attorney Catherine Gallagher, your lawsuit was filed in a federal court, and the defendants that your Palestinian plaintiffs were suing were President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of Defense Austin. From a factual as opposed to a legal point of view, what was it that you claimed each of these defendants did and are doing that caused them to be defendants in this case?
Thank you. From a factual standpoint, we sued these three senior U.S. officials in their official capacity. So we sued them as the head of the State Department, as the head of the Defense Department, and as the President of the United States, including in his capacity as, Commander-in-Chief and Overseer of the Executive Departments, including State Department and Defense Department. And what we set forth in our 85-page complaint, as well as, again, in our opposition to the government's motion to dismiss, is a dense factual accounting of the many ways that these three individuals and the departments and offices that they oversee have stood shoulder to shoulder with Israel from October 8th onwards, giving material support, moral encouragement, and in their own words, no red lines for the way that U.S. support was being used and is being used at this moment against the Palestinian population in Gaza. So concretely, what that looks like is rushing weapons to Israel to be used again against the Palestinian population and to enforce a total siege against the population. So that is the situation that has sealed the Gaza Strip, as 1.8 million people were quote-unquote evacuated from the north to the south and under continual and constant bombardment, a situation that has led to literally tens of thousands of deaths, including over 10,000 Palestinian children being killed, and that has led to the entirety of the Gaza Strip now on the brink of famine and starvation. That is what the total siege and the military bombardment, which has also taken out the vast majority of the healthcare system in Gaza and destroyed basic necessities like water lines and sewerage lines, while Israel is also cutting off access to electricity and food and fuel. So with that situation, the United States has sent munitions, whether it's shells to be used in the bombing, JDAMs would cause massive explosions or bunker busting bombs. So rushing more weapons and continuing to do that, including bypassing any kind of congressional oversight, which is what we saw happen twice in December, by which point there were already warnings by the United Nations of the fact that Israel's intentions appear to be genocidal. So with the knowledge that there was a serious risk of genocide, if not an active genocide, the United States rushed weapons. Secretary of Defense Austin opened the stockpile in Israel for Israel's use, and there is an estimated $4.4 billion worth of weapons there so that Israel can just make use of those weapons. So it's rushing more for tanks, for shells, for massive bombs. Of course, the United States also provides much of the F-35s, which are used to drop bombs. The United States has also had drones over Gaza, so the United States is fully aware of the massive toll on Palestinian life and the destruction to Gaza that is going on. And that's on the military side. And then on the diplomatic side, we've seen these senior U.S. officials show up in Israel and offer any support that is needed. And until very recently, continuing to say with no red lines. And it's not so much that the United States has placed any conditions on the use of weapons, but it's trying to put some language around the side of, oh, we should be letting in some humanitarian aid, addressing the situation in Gaza as if it was a natural disaster, rather than the fact that what we are seeing right now, more than 4 months into this, is the implementation of a genocidal plan that has been backed politically by the United States, as it has vetoed ceasefire resolutions, as it has continued to refuse to follow the calls of the vast majority of the United States, of the population and of the world, for a permanent ceasefire and an end to the carnage. We've seen continued diplomatic support for Israel and refusal to stop the flow of weapons that are being used to kill Palestinian children today in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. My goodness. Well, you know, Catherine Gallagher, I have no doubt that you, more than I, are aware of the fact that the Center for Constitutional Rights is very often, thanks to Michael Ratner, who I think kind of pioneered this, a former founder and chair of CCR, this idea that if a case is important enough, if facts are big enough and important enough, that even though you know that there may be legal barriers to a successful outcome of the suit, you don't hesitate to bring it because it still can have a powerful impact, as I think we'll see this case is having. So in that regard, I suspect you and the other fine attorneys at CCR knew the plaintiffs had a huge legal barrier to overcome if they were going to secure any relief for their clients. And I'm referring, of course, to the issue of suing a U.S. administration over matters involving its conduct not on domestic affairs, but on foreign affairs. So explain why that is the case and what legal arguments you made in an attempt to overcome that defense by the Biden administration.
Sure. Just to kind of look back historically, and Michael, I am privileged that he was a mentor to me, and I am a deep believer that we have to confront in any ways that we can as lawyers abuses of power. And in that vein, CCR had brought a number of cases on behalf of victims of U.S. supported Israeli war crimes about 15 years ago, and we lost three cases at that time: the case Corey v. Caterpillar, the case against Avi Dichter for the dropping of a one-ton bomb on Gaza in a densely populated area, killing 15 civilians, and it's just remarkable that that El Daraj bombing in 2002 was something that was condemned globally, and you look now at how many one-ton bombs or more are being dropped almost daily on Gaza, with the world accepting it. But so we had the Dichter case, the Caterpillar case, and then a case around the bombing of a UN safe haven in Kana against Yalon. So those were three cases that we ended up losing, each of them, between 2005 and 2010, either on immunity grounds or political question grounds. And what we saw at that time was that the courts maybe weren't ready for cases like that, whether it was the corporate accountability side of things with Caterpillar or involving U.S. support for broad support for Israel's policies. Fast forward to where we are now, and it was very clear to us from those initial statements that were made by the Israeli defense minister, Israeli president, Israeli prime minister, that what was the intention of Israel in not only in rhetoric but in an action plan was genocidal. And so our calculus of whether or not to bring a case, that shifted here. And it shifted not only because of the severity of the harm and the need to raise that in a court, the fact that we were talking about genocide, which is universally recognized as really the most serious crime, a crime that the United States has recognized to be a violation of customary international law, and a crime that carries with it the duty to prevent, so that you should be taking action at the front end, not waiting until after tens of thousands of people or more have been killed, but that states have an obligation to do everything they can to save lives as soon as there is a serious risk. So we thought it was important to operationalize these legal principles against genocide, principles, again, that the United States helped enshrine in the Genocide Convention and has, as recently as last year, in the Ukraine v. Russia case at the International Court of Justice, affirmed. So we saw that there was clear law here. And then we've also seen over the last 5 to 10 years an evolution in the understanding of the political question doctrine. Already back at the time of Guantanamo, we had the Supreme Court make clear that a situation like war is not a, quote, blank check for the executive branch. But even more so in recent years, in the case that we're litigating, the El-Shamari case against Kaki, the Abu Ghraib torture case, we had a very clear decision out of the Fourth Circuit that when you're talking about violations of the law, like the prohibition against torture, that cannot be a political question. The political question doctrine has been about the judiciary not second-guessing policy decisions or making value determinations around optional foreign policy. When you're talking about genocide, that is a legal prohibition. It cannot be a policy choice. So similarly to what the Fourth Circuit found with regard to torture, and what the Supreme Court made clear in a case called Zivotofsky, that when there is a alleged violation of the Constitution or of a clear statute, especially a statute, again, it cannot be a policy choice. There is no review here because the political branches have already spoken. And just as genocide has been criminalized, that is a decision that the political branches took to criminalize genocide. So again, it can't be a policy decision. So we've seen that there are a number of legal decisions along these lines, including one related to genocide out of the D.C. Circuit. So we actually don't believe that this is a case that can't be won and that the courts can't review. We believe that there is a clear role for the courts when we are talking about a violation not only of a black letter law like the crime of genocide, but when we are talking about really what's viewed as the crime of crimes, one that is universally prohibited. It can't be that the President of the United States, that Joe Biden, decides that furthering a genocide is a policy choice. It's unlawful.
Now, Catherine, ultimately, the judge in the case did grant the U.S. government's motion to dismiss it, but the judge, in doing so, nevertheless, made some rather remarkable statements in the course of his ruling, Catherine. Tell us about these statements and what the judge said.
Sure. What was clear, just going back to the hearing that we had on January 26th, we had the legal argument that day about the political question, and then we also had at least 3 hours of testimony, again, from our plaintiffs. Ahmed Abu Ful spoke on behalf of El Haq, and he spoke about the loss of over 60 family members. As I mentioned, Leila El Haddad spoke about the loss of more than 80 members of her family on her mother's side and multiple members of her family on her father's side, and that these family members had been killed with U.S.-supplied weapons. Bassem El-Kara, whose family is a long-time Gaza family, spoke about having spent summers visiting his grandfather and the family home, which has been destroyed. Monad Herzla spoke about how one of his cousins, who was like a brother to him, had already lost 3 sons over the course of the Israeli assault on Gaza. And unfortunately, even since the hearing, his cousin Maher lost a 4th son. So we had these very, very powerful hours of testimony that Judge White seemed deeply engaged and very affected by what he was hearing as the plaintiffs spoke about not only the impact of the current assault, but spoke historically also about the Nakba and how that is very much in the minds of their families now, how so many of their families are in fact even refugees in Gaza because of the Nakba and ethnic cleansing that they face in other parts of historic Palestine. So at the conclusion of the hearing, Judge White said that this was really, in his 20-plus years on the bench, one of the most difficult factual, if not the most difficult factual and legal questions, and again, seemed very troubled, but did wonder about the role of the courts, particularly since it was the executive branch's decision to support Israel in this genocidal campaign. So his decision ultimately did dismiss the case on political question grounds, and we have just filed our notice of appeal, so we will be appealing the decision. But in so doing, he made a number of observations and conclusions, including laying out what the International Court of Justice had found the same day that we had the hearing, and that's that there is a plausible case of genocide. And then he himself came to that same conclusion, and he noted that there is, quote, undisputed evidence before his court that comports with the findings of the ICJ and indicates that the current treatment of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip by the Israeli military may plausibly constitute a genocide in violation of international law. That is a very, very powerful finding, and he continued on. that the statements by various officials of the Israeli government, quote, indicate that the ongoing military siege in Gaza is intended to eradicate a whole people and therefore plausibly fall within the international prohibition against genocide. And he noted that it is every individual's obligation to confront the current siege in Gaza. And then in his closing, he pointed out the support that the U.S. government is giving and, quote, implores defendants to examine the results of their, quote, unflagging support of the military siege against the Palestinians in Gaza. So in essence, what he found is that there is an ongoing genocide in Gaza and that it is happening with U.S. support. And so we hope that already having these findings, both by a federal court in California and by the International Court of Justice, a court that the Biden administration itself has called on other states, including Russia, to support and acknowledge the weight of decisions, that these decisions would impact the course of action by both the executive branch and the congressional branch. Unfortunately, what we see is continued support going to Israel. We see the aid package or the military support package being discussed and debated in Congress, and it's not failing because people are concerned about a genocide. So we still need to see a fundamental shift by the Biden administration in line with what the judge said, to really examine the results of their unflagging support for the military siege against Palestinians in Gaza.
Some of your last thoughts for the time we have left, where our listeners could learn more about the lawsuit and the work by the Center for Constitutional Rights, and as I say, your last thoughts on the suit we've been talking about.
Sure. I think just on the hearing that we had, two thoughts on that. One was that the plaintiffs and the attorneys were inside the court, and it was closed to the public. But outside the courthouse, there was just a massive rally, a massive support to the plaintiffs on a day that they each individually said was just so powerful, in a moment that they could bring their families, their truths, their histories into a official government building and have it heard. So for our plaintiffs, it was a powerful day. But to look outside and see streets of Oakland shut down and massive protests that had painted Biden as complicit in genocide and a huge banner hanging that said that same message. So inside and outside, we were united in our calls for the Biden administration to end their support for genocide. That is why our plaintiffs have filed this case. It is one that CCR is on all fronts working very, very hard to ensure that we have not only success in the courtroom on appeal, but that our message is heard by policymakers, by advocates and activists in the media, to try and do whatever we can to stop the flow of weapons, to stop the flow of diplomatic support for a genocide, and really to save lives in Gaza. So I do think that while it's a legal case, it is certainly part of a much larger movement, and I am hopeful we need to have some end to this horror as quickly as we can. And to learn more about the case, I would suggest just go to our website, ccrjustice.org, and you will be able to find right there on the homepage information about the case.
Oh, my goodness. It's just great. My hat's off to you and to all the wonderful folks who have worked on this case at CCR. I hope our listeners will follow the good advice you've given to check it out on your wonderful website. Thank you so much for your work and for joining us today here on Law and Disorder, Catherine.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. You take it easy, Catherine.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Some years ago, Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a co-founder of Law and Disorder Radio, interviewed our returning guest, attorney Benjamin Carter Hett. Hett is an historian, a professor at Hunter College, and a lawyer. He wrote a biography of the great German leftist attorney Hans Litten, who cross-examined Hitler, almost stopping him from coming to power by exposing Hitler's hypocrisy on the use of violence. As Michael wrote about Professor Hett's book, quote, it brings to life the period preceding the takeover of Germany by Nazis. Litten's cross-examination of Hitler went to the heart of the Nazis' attempt to achieve power through violence. Trump has promised to do the same thing should he get elected. Professor Hett recently wrote about this in an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times. In an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity, Trump said he wanted to be a dictator, quote, on the first day of his new administration. It has been reported that Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act, which would allow him to deploy troops to crush protests, arrest dissidents, and shut down oppositional media. Trump is a fascist. He's not an advocate of the rule of law or of democracy. He boasts about using violence. In the divorce papers his first wife Ivana Trump filed against him, she alleged that he kept a book of Hitler's speeches at his bed table. Like Hitler, Trump appeals to his base and their desire for, quote, retribution. Trump said, we pledge, quote, to you that we will root out communists and radicals and left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country. Hitler's racism was shown by his anti-Semitism, Trump's by his hatred of immigrants, who he says, echoing Hitler, quote, will poison American blood. Our guest, Benjamin Carter Hett, joins us. He is a former trial lawyer. He is now a professor of history at Hunter College and the author of several books, including Crossing Hitler, The Man Who Put the Nazis on the Witness Stand. Most recently, he has written an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times titled, 2024 could be the year America fends off dictatorship or invites it in. Professor Hett, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be back with you.
Ben, American democracy is already greatly diminished. There's been a good deal of talk about how Trump, who almost certainly will be the Republican Party candidate for president, engages in talk speech similar to that of Hitler, as Hitler was fighting for power in Germany. You've written that Trump did not start out as a fully developed fascist, but that he's become one. Can you please talk about this?
Sure. So in my view, and I think there are probably I know there are a lot of people who would disagree about this, but in my view at least, I think there are two things that are important about Trump. One is that he's quite, to put it bluntly, he's just jaw-droppingly stupid. He has very little ability to take information on board. The second thing is he has no knowledge to start with. So he has no knowledge. He's unable to acquire knowledge. And so I think he has pretty much literally zero understanding of political ideas and political ideology. And I really don't think he's consciously a fascist or anything like that. What I do think is that he has personal, I think he has emotional, psychological problems, basically, that have impelled him sort of instinctively to take positions which are, in effect and in content, fascist. And so I think that's what we're seeing play out a little bit. His incredible insecurity making him unable to accept any kind of rejection is, I think, behind his rejection of the 2020 election results, and lots of things flow from that, his desire for revenge. He keeps talking about retribution. And then added to this, I think he has a genuine kind of gut-level racism, which is coming out more and more when he says things like, immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country, which is very straight out fascist, racist, articulation. I don't think he sort of knows that consciously. I think it's kind of a gut thing. So I see him as this kind of instinctive gut fascist, if you will. And I think his political good fortune is that a bunch of resentment that he feels and can do nothing other than articulate, because I think he has no discipline to control the message. I think he has no calculation about what he says. Just what he sort of spontaneously lets out resonates with about a third of the electorate who happen to feel the same resentments and come in many ways from sort of the same place emotionally. And I think that explains, in my view at least, that explains the hold that he has gotten on a lot of the Republican base. And it explains why a lot of more rational Republicans have been unable to dislodge him from that control of the Republican base. But it's also why no other Republican has been able to replicate the formula, it seems. No one else, no matter how repugnant they are, seems to be able to acquire that same kind of hold of the base. Trump just has this kind of, you know, almost Vulcan mind meld, I think, with a substantial chunk of Republican voters.
In this regard, you've also written about the fact that many Americans seem to want that kind of dictatorial governance that a Trump presidency would promise. Indeed, a recent mayor's poll, I think of it yesterday or the day before, just showed that that's become that issue of whether we're going to remain a democracy or not has become a number one issue among American voters. But nevertheless, with respect to this question of a dictatorship, many Americans seem to prefer that as well. What percentage of Americans and why? And you point out that Hitler and the Nazis in Germany, for that matter, got 44% of the German people's vote. So Hitler came to power legally, didn't he? In this regard, what are you afraid of here with Trump? For example, are you afraid that if elected, Trump would, as promised, invoke the Insurrection Act on his first day in office? Talk to us about this.
Yeah, okay, so there's a lot of things there. So the constituency in the American electorate for dictatorship, I mean, I don't know if I have the knowledge to say very precisely, but it seems to me roughly coterminous with Trump's base, which would be around a third of the total electorate and maybe two-thirds or so of the Republican electorate. And, you know, from things I've read or for things I've heard on the radio or seen on TV and whatnot from people who are experts on specific areas of this, it seems to me that there is a broad current of feeling among a lot of people in the United States, I think particularly white people, particularly evangelicals, who feel that the country has come to such a pass that in a sense it is moving so far away from anything that they can identify with or feel works for them or that they can relate to, that the only solution now is a drastic one. The only way to basically stop pluralist, multiracial democracy is with an authoritarian solution that can enforce basically a kind of white nationalist, Christian, anti-democratic ascendancy. So I think if there is much coherent ideology underpinning Trump, it's probably that. I mean, I think that that's the thing that for some people who are kind of on Trump's side, this is somewhat thought through, this is somewhat consciously thought through and articulated as an ideology. And so it has a resonance with, you know, substantial bodies of conservative voters, particularly in rural, southern, and largely white areas. This is in some ways quite similar to Germany in the 1930s in the sense that I think a core element here, a core unifying element, is a feeling of humiliation. And I've always said, I've written this a few times, in my view, humiliation is the most dangerous political emotion, because if you feel that I have humiliated you, that will probably provoke you into a reaction which won't have much limit. I mean, I think that humiliation and desire for revenge from humiliation is such a powerful thing that that's where we tend to see, in almost all cases, I think, extremist politics gets born out of that. A lot of Germans in the 1930s felt that. A lot of Germans felt that they had been humiliated by foreign powers, they had been humiliated in part by their own government, or they'd been humiliated by other sections of the German population, or all of the above. And that gave wings to the Nazis and explained a lot of their electoral constituency, which in fully free elections netted them about a third of the electorate. When they got 43%, which they did once, in an only semi-free election in March of 1933, but that election was already only semi-free, and that was their best, even semi-free electoral performance. In fully free elections, about a third of the electorate was the best they could do, driven by that, I think, primarily the element of humiliation. Now, in terms of what I'm afraid of for the United States, you know, I would really rather Trump didn't win, because I do think, you know, I do think he will feel that he has no limitations on what he could try to do as president. And I am quite sure that a second Trump administration would not contain some of the fairly reasonable figures who were in, at least in part, in the first Trump administration. There would not be, so to speak, any adults in the room. He would have nuts characters like General Flynn occupying key positions, and there would be no internal check. I often think of a quote, a guy who was very important in the early days of the Nazi regime was a man named Rudolf Diels, who was the first chief of the Gestapo, the secret police. And Diels managed to survive the war, and in the 50s, he positioned himself as someone who had been anti-Nazi, and he wrote once in the 1950s that he was worried that the Nazis were going to come back in Germany, and he wrote, and when they come back, they won't start again in 1933, they'll start again at 1945. In other words, they'll start again at the most extreme place they have got to. And I think that will happen with Trump. If he comes back, he won't start again at 2017, he'll start again, you know, kind of around January 6, 2021. He'll start again with that. So I would not be surprised if he tries to invoke the Insurrection Act to stop protesters. I would not be surprised that almost anything he might do, trying to use government powers to shut down media outlets to criticize him, certainly, he said as much, certainly using the justice system to go after individual people that he thinks are enemies of him. I think you can basically count on that happening. It will be a severe, unprecedented attack on the rule of law in America, on freedom, on democracy, on basically anything that we might ever have thought constitutes the American political identity. That said, and this is something we can pursue a lot, and I'll stop with this, I don't see that quite as darkly as some people, because I think there would be resistance, not from Republicans, but from outside Republican Party and lawmaking circles. I think there would be a lot of resistance from Americans, and I think America has a lot of antidotes against fascism. So I think Trump would try to be a dictator, and he would try to do terrible things. I suspect he would mostly fail, probably not completely fail, but I think he would mostly fail. So that's, I guess that's my take on where it comes from and what I'm afraid of might happen.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner and co-host, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Benjamin Carter Hett, who's a former trial lawyer and now a history professor. Ben, Hitler based much of his appeal on resentment, the feeling of resentment that the German people felt after they were defeated in World War I and by the onerous treaty the Allies imposed on Germany after the war. Is there anything like that here in America that echoes the German people's resentment? Trump supporters in America today say that they feel that, and that is an indication of his popularity. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the areas in which there is actually a quite close and in many ways quite alarming parallel between Germany then and America now. I think one side of this has to do with what Trump and his people always invoke as globalism, which is an interesting word which has all kinds of resonances, some of them quite consciously sort of coded anti-Semitism. But the whole idea that there's a world out there that's malevolently hostile to America and needs to be resisted by asserting, as Trump puts it, America first, you know, this playing to a sense of American resentment of other powers' economic impact on the United States, the effects of trade, the effects of outsourcing of jobs, all this whole sort of package of things that particularly Trumpist politicians are invoking when they invoke globalism, with a little shot of anti-Semitism, to be sure. How often do they talk with George Soros or somebody like that? This tracks quite closely on one of the, or probably the most successful Nazi message when they had to win free elections, which was a very similar appeal to nationalism as a defense against globalization, which the Nazis also always rhetorically coded as Jewish. In researching this, I've sometimes found some quite striking things. The Nazis' main propagandist, Josef Goebbels, who edited a newspaper, wrote in his newspaper in 1932, quoting here, do we want to build a wall around Germany? Yes, we want to build a wall. It's kind of striking that even that very same imagery is being used to express express, you know, a nationalist, they might have said Germany first, response to globalization. So I think that's part of it. And then the other part, I think, is internal. It's kind of what I was saying before. One of the many interesting things about Germany in the early 30s is that it had a kind of red state, blue state division that in some ways tracks quite closely onto American experience, and especially in terms of Berlin versus the rest of the country. Because, you know, Berlin, you know, this is something everybody knows, you know, if you've watched Babylon Berlin or whatever, you know, I mean, Berlin was really ground zero of all kinds of aspects of modernization, and modernization of art, you know, music, a really large and quite successful gay rights movement, women's movement, you know, sort of sexual liberation of all kinds. And certainly Berlin has throughout its history always been politically liberal and left in what has often been a generally conservative country. So there was this feeling among a lot of Germans, especially right-wing Germans, that Berlin is like fundamentally alien to Germany, but that's where the power is, and we're being run from Berlin. And all the Berliners do is look down their nose at everybody outside of Berlin, and they think we're inferior. They think we're just peasants with pitchforks. You know, so there's a lot of hatred of Berlin and what it kind of symbolizes, and what it kind of symbolizes is everything liberal, modern, you know, socially progressive. And of course, we see that same kind of dynamic here, and it comes out in so many ways. Like, look at, you know, what's happening with governors of Florida sending you know, migrants to, you know, what they like to call sanctuary cities in the north, which are always liberal-run cities, New York, Chicago, whatever. I mean, this is just one little straw in the wind of this whole kind of resentment of progressive, liberal, urbanized spaces by the spaces outside of those spaces, which are the spaces that vote for Trump, you know. So I think, you know, and Trump never wins big cities. That kind of political dynamic, I think, is quite strikingly similar from the German experience of back then to the American experience now.
I wonder, Benjamin, let's take one of the parts of the question you just answered and see if we can elaborate on it a bit, because it does seem rather central. And you point out the similarities around nationalism and racism, what have you. Talk a bit about what those similarities are between Hitler's appeal to the German nationalism and racism and Trump's appeal to racism and, well, white American nationalism.
Both Hitler and Trump made rhetorical appeals to nationalism, which at first blush sound like they're being kind of inclusive, but in fact are quite exclusive of definite designated parts of the country. So, you know, the Nazis made a big deal out of being positioning themselves as being socially egalitarian and saying they want to break down class boundaries, they want to break down, you know, religious group boundaries, at least between Catholics and Protestants. They want to break down sort of geographic rivalries within Germany and create a one German identity. They want the country to be unified, you know, all Germans to be equal, all Germans to be one. But then, of course, that comes with a bunch of footnotes, and they never really articulate the footnotes, but they're there. You know, the footnotes are, does not apply if you're Jewish, does not apply if you're a communist, does not apply if you are gay, does not apply if you suffer from a disability, you know, does not apply if you are Sinti or Roma. Other than that, all Germans are one, and all Germans should be united. And it's a bit the same with Trump. If you think about his inaugural address in 2017, where he said, you know, he's fighting for the forgotten man, and he sort of often has this rhetoric that he's going to bring back the greatness of America and bring back a unity. But of course, then rhetorically, he doesn't even try sometimes to speak to substantial groups of the country which he has identified as enemies. So it's a nationalism which is actually highly exclusive. And a lot of people have pointed out that when Trump speaks, he codes things in such a way to really be speaking to white evangelicals, and they pick up the message. So he's really kind of speaking, nowadays especially, I think first and foremost, to white evangelicals with a rhetoric of nationalism that is meant to exclude, like, basically, you know, more than half of the country, you know, people of color, people with, you know, people who are immigrants or children of immigrants, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Ben, Hitler pretended to respect the rule of law, but he used violence. And Trump has also proclaimed that he supports the rule of law, but he also talks about using violence. He talks about he wants to root out the vermin and the communists and the socialists and so on. Talk to us about what was done to the rule of law in Nazi Germany and how the rule of law is being eroded today here in the USA.
Yeah, you know, Hitler played a quite complicated game with the rule of law, especially rhetorically. In some ways, Trump is simpler, but I'll get to that in a sec. When Hitler was not in power, when he was campaigning to be in power, he realized that to win free elections, he had to rhetorically present himself as someone who would follow the law, respect the Constitution. So he always said that over and over again in speeches, even in court testimony. He would insist that the Nazi Party was constitutional, they would follow the law. But then there were sort of two caveats to this. One caveat is that his party had its own paramilitary force, you know, famously known as the Brown Shirts, also known as the Storm Troopers, whose job before the Nazis were in power was to find the actually similar paramilitary activists of other political parties, especially the communists, find them and get into fights with them. So the German politics in those days was actually a kind of gang warfare between the paramilitary gangs of thugs of different parties. And every party kind of had its gang of thugs. Even the relatively moderate Social Democrats had their political gangs that were out there fighting with the Nazi thugs and the communist thugs and the thugs of the kind of mainstream right nationalist party and so on and so on. So Hitler's always doing this difficult dance, and he had to speak differently to different parts of his constituency. To win elections, especially to get middle-class voters, he had to say, you know, legal, 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 constitution, constitution. Then he has to turn to his stormtroopers and basically kind of say, I'm just kidding, let's use violence to overturn the system. And he did really use both. I mean, his party won elections, and he was then appointed chancellor by the president in a theoretically fully constitutional way. But then they used violence to consolidate their power. Once they were in power, the stormtroopers were out, you know, en masse, rounding up political opponents, rounding up communists and liberals and socialists and other kinds of people like that who were Nazi opponents, and imprisoning them in completely unofficial prisons and torturing them and beating them and killing them. So it's this kind of tricky game with legality. All the while, Hitler liked to pose publicly as a champion of law, meanwhile, right from the beginning, his people are engaged in lawlessness. Trump is similar a bit. If anything, Trump is less rhetorically careful than Hitler. And I put this down to basically that he's much less intelligent and much less calculating. Hitler was both of those things, which we don't always like to, I think, acknowledge, but it was true. Hitler wouldn't have got where he got if he wasn't cunning and he wasn't calculating. Trump is, I think, extraordinarily unable to engage in political calculus and discipline what he says. So stuff comes out, you know, when he says, you know, I'll be a dictator on day one and I'll be your retribution and all the sort of threats that he issues, it's because he can't control himself. He's not capable of the kind of tricky rhetorical performance that Hitler pulled off. But that said, I think they would end up in about the same place. I think, you know, a President Trump in 2025 would be doing a lot of what Hitler was doing. He would be pursuing his enemies, perhaps often with violence, or he would have surrogates, like, you know, maybe Proud Boys or somebody like that, pursuing his enemies with violence. He would be using the judicial system to pursue enemies, of course, very much as the Nazis did. I think all of that would be much the same, while perhaps at some rhetorical level, Trump would say he's just, you know, restoring the Constitution to what it should be or something like that. I would not be surprised to see, you know, that kind of performance happening in a renewed Trump administration.
In light of what you've just said, the fact that Trump is so much more open, flagrantly open about what he would do and the rather outrageous things he would do. He's not subtle at all. Does that give you more concern that he still enjoys as much support as he does then?
It gives me massive concern. We're at a place I honestly never dreamed we'd be in America, that he could have said and done all the things that he had said and done and still have the support that he does, still be an entirely viable candidate for president. I think this is an experience that none of us have had in our lifetimes, and for any kind of parallel, you'd have to reach back, you know, a century or more. You know, I thought, like a lot of people probably, I thought after January 6th, I thought, okay, well, that's it. You know, he's finally done. Even the Republicans won't take this. But, of course, they have. So honestly, I have no idea what else he could possibly do to antagonize that seemingly immovable third of the electorate that stays with him.
Trump is on trial, criminal trial, in Georgia and in D.C. and in Florida. What do you think is going to happen there? And are those trials going to get concluded before November of this year when the election takes place?
As to whether those trials are going to conclude before November, probably your guess is as good as mine, or actually probably your guess is better than mine. What it looks like right now is that maybe one or two or even more of them might be happening in the fall, right as the campaign is underway, and that'll be interesting. Whether they'll conclude, I suspect, because I'm sure whatever happens, it would be appeals. How that process works out, I think we'll only really see if Trump loses, in which case those cases will continue. Of course, if Trump wins, at least the federal cases will be over. But the Georgia case may keep going, depending on all the variables there. You know, I think the other interesting thing is what effect it has. And I think there's a real question as to how much you can achieve political goals with judicial processes. It seems to me, on evidence available so far, that the prosecutions of Trump have probably had no effect on moving the dial one way or another on his popularity, other than, I think, to solidify his hold on his own base, which seems to happen. There doesn't seem to have been any reduction in his popularity from all these charges. We keep seeing polls saying that even some of his core voters would think again if he were actually convicted. It's difficult for me to believe, after all that we've seen Trump do, which has had no impact whatsoever on his base, it's difficult for me to believe that something that they might easily construe as a frame-up by the deep state would suddenly change their mind. I think the only thing we can do is beat him at the ballot box.
Unfortunately, Ben, we've come to the end of our allotted time. We're going to have to say goodbye. But before we do that, can you tell our listeners how people can follow your work?
Sure. You can find information about me at my website, which is BenjaminCarterHet.com. I've written 6 books, which are all available on Amazon and other similar outlets. My books are generally all about German history, the Nazis, the run-up to World War II, and the rule of law and the role of law in German history.
Thank you again. Let me add my thanks and appreciation to a very clear and convincing and understandable presentation. We thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Coming up, listeners, a special TaxCast broadcast that came out a while back, but it's heralding and announcing a special UN Tax Justice Convention to be held March 14th and 15th in Paris, France. I'm very excited about it. They're actually trying to set up a security registry where the billionaires and hundreds of millionaires and thousands of very wealthy people who move their money to avoid paying taxes, hide their money in Panama, all these places, are going to have to register. We're going to create a list of governments where they have to register where their money's at. It's a tax justice convention, March 14th and 15th in France. That's just coming up here in a few weeks. And here, after this music, is an announcement about it. Thank you for listening. I'll see you Friday. Thank you.
And if it's naughty to them, some men sleep each morning after 10, then the answer is yes, I wanna be dead. Nobody cares just how blue and how lonesome I am. If I have troubles and laugh, why they don't give a damn. So credit, if it's small, to let someone pay. Just a little kiss by mistake. Let a lady confess I wanna be sad. Da 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 da.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're joining us from. Thank you very much for joining us in this event, in the second in the 2023 series of Tax Justice Network events. That broad series is titled Early Sightings of a New Tax Justice Era, and the optimism contained in that is largely about what we're going to discuss today, which is the process of moving towards a UN tax convention. So what we're looking at is the process that really began last year with a resolution that passed at the UN General Assembly by unanimous consensus, so every United Nations member state agreeing to begin intergovernmental discussions on the possibility of an international tax cooperation framework under UN auspices. Now, that resolution also gave a mandate to the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, to produce a report looking at the options. That report was published in August and scheduled a debate at the General Assembly held last week to debate the Secretary General's report to consider those options. Now, we heard from a range of high-level speakers in that event, and the moderator, the chair of the G24 group of intergovernmental group, actually concluded the debate by suggesting that a consensus was emerging around option two from the Secretary General's report. And this is the option that has broad support across civil society and it appears in the G77 group also. And this is the option of a framework convention on tax, which has the possibility both to create individual protocols to put in place globally inclusive rules and standards, but also of creating a convention body for the future negotiation of tax rules. And I think the reason why there is this emerging support for option two is, in a sense, it's the option that doesn't close any doors before negotiations begin. So it leaves the possibility both of binding protocols, but also the creation of a UN tax body intact for countries then to negotiate. What we're looking forward to now is the possibility of the next resolution, which could begin those negotiations formally and perhaps begin to set a schedule. And that's what we'll be discussing today. The context of that, of course, is, you know, per the State of Tax Justice estimates, countries around the world lose something like $480 billion a year, let's call it around $500 billion, to cross-border tax abuse by multinational companies and by individuals hiding their assets and income streams offshore every year. In some countries, that's 10 or 20% of their public health budget. In other countries, it's 50 or even 100%. In some countries, including India, for example, those losses, estimated losses, exceed the public health budget. So we're talking about revenues with the potential to do enormous good if they could be recovered. And of course, the spirit of this convention is very much in line with what was agreed in the Sustainable Development Goals in 2015, which put tax in first place as the primary means of implementation for the entire framework and committed countries to greater international cooperation. Now, 8 years later, halfway through the SDG period, we haven't yet seen that international cooperation, and this convention process is really the beginning of it. But there's a long road to go. What we're going to do today is hear from a set of experts from all around the world who've engaged in this process in different ways, some directly in the work of the UN, others from the civil society side, or analysing from academia, or in the case of Dr. Valdez, from the Colombian government, which has been an important player so far in this process. So I'll introduce the speakers. We'll hear from each of them, and then we'll go into a discussion session followed by a Q&A. Let me ask the audience let me point out two things. The first, that we have interpretation, so you'll find that at the bottom of your Zoom screen. This is available in French, Spanish, Portuguese, and English. And secondly, if you'd like to put questions for us to look at in the Q&A, then that's also available from the bottom of your screen, and we'll try and get through as many of those questions as we can. Okay, let me move to the introductions, because we do have a really fantastic panel today to consider this. So we'll hear first from Mr. Navid Hanif, who is the Assistant Secretary General of UNDESA, the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. Now, Navid has been involved in UN processes in all sorts of areas over the last 20 years, but including with DESA and positions in ECOSOC. So he's absolutely embedded in the financing for development process. And of course, DESA provided the staff to support the Secretary General's report. And so we can hear very directly about the process of producing that report, it's the options that it sets out, and where perhaps we go from here in terms of the next steps that were identified. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Maria Fernandez Valdez, who's the Deputy Minister of Finance for Colombia. Now, Dr. Valdez has worked on tax, particularly tax and inequality. Indeed, has a book, a very good book on that very subject. After studying in Colombia, in the Netherlands, in Germany, working for the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, and now holding this important post in government. And of course, it's Colombia that hosted, with the co-lead of Brazil and Chile, the Cartagena process, including a summit a couple of months ago, to bring together regional discussions across Latin America and the Caribbean on just these issues, policies to curb tax abuse within the region, and the possibility of a common position in United Nations discussions. Then we'll hear from Dr. Leila Latif, who's a lawyer based in Kenya, who studied and worked in the UK also, a very significant figure in the Committee for Fiscal Studies at the University of Nairobi, and also we are delighted to recognise a non-executive director of the Tax Justice Network. And Dr. Latif has worked on a set of pieces of work in this area, including supporting important African policy processes around the emerging common African position, recognising that Africa as a group has led this process both at the UN and in terms of regional coordination, going back to the high-level panel on illicit financial flows out of Africa, chaired by former South African President Thabo Mbeki from the early 2010s. Now, last but not least, we'll hear from Tova Riding, who's the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Eurodad, and also one of the elected regional representatives of Tax Justice Europe within the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, which is the umbrella body for mass mobilization organizations all around the world on this issue. Tova is also the author of a draft text for a UN tax convention. And if you haven't read that, I really recommend that as a kind of both a very exciting document itself, also a very good way to get a sense of the kind of the set of options that we're really looking at when we talk about a UN tax convention. And I'm sure Tova will speak to that when she speaks. Okay, enough from me. I remind you again once more about the interpretation. And I'll introduce now and hand over to our first speaker, Mr. Navid Hanif, the Assistant Secretary General of UNDESA. Navid, we're delighted to have you here, having led this process, and really interested to hear your thoughts on, you know, the Secretary General's report and the debate last week, and where perhaps we can go from here. So over to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and greetings to everyone. And I'm honored to join this distinguished panel. But also let me congratulate the Access This Network for your 20th anniversary and your outstanding contribution to this work so far. And Alex, personally, your commitment and your drive to advance ideas which can bring greater equity and fairness to the tax system globally. Focus my presentation in three parts, basically. First and foremost, the context. We cannot discuss this issue in a vacuum. Where are we in terms of the Sustainable Development Goals, illicit financial flows, and our efforts to mobilize resources for both climate action and sustainable development agenda? The summit that was held last week here, both Climate Action Summit and the SDG Summit, both had message of hope and determination, but the overall assessment was very sobering. We are lagging far behind on the sustainable development goals, actually going in reverse in some areas. And also climate action, we are falling short of the agreements made in Paris. So the issue of resource mobilization was at the center of all these conversations. In the conversation on tax, especially effective international tax cooperation can significantly enhance our efforts to fight illicit financial flows, increase domestic resource mobilization, which is key for investing in the SDGs. Then let me come to the high-level dialogue on financing for development. And Alex, you mentioned the statement by G24. I would say the message was unambiguously clear. They would like to move global tax cooperation, which is more inclusive, rather fully inclusive and more effective. So these were the key words in the resolution that was adopted last year by the General Assembly. And that's when the Secretary General's report came out in response to that resolution. And before I get to the report, let me also mention this debate is a debate about taxing rights, tax sovereignty of countries. And that's why it becomes even more important. It's not just resources. It's not just equity and fairness. It's also a question of letting sovereign states exercise their rights. So what is the report? How did we conceive the report, and what is the report offering? And I will then mention the next steps quickly. You know, the SC wanted to be very open and transparent, so we sought inputs from all over the world and from all stakeholders, and I want to thank civil society and activists who contributed in a very meaningful manner. But we received 80 inputs, 80 points of views. And those really enriched our work. So if we apply the two criteria in the resolution, fully inclusive and more effective, the report comes to the conclusion nothing, neither the UN Tax Committee nor the OECD and other jurisdictions or entities working on this fully meets the benchmark of inclusiveness and effectiveness, both on substance and on process. So that's where the report, I think, because of the resolution's content and the 80 inputs we received, breaks new ground. It doesn't acknowledge anything that's going on which would fulfill this criteria. If these criteria cannot be met, what to do? Report comes up with the conclusion, and based on evidence and analysis, UN's role in tax norm setting appears to be the most viable path forward to make international tax cooperation fully inclusive and more effective. So we have presented three options. One of the options, Alex, you already mentioned in detail. Option one is multilateral convention international tax cooperation. It would be regulatory in nature and set out a potentially broad range of obligations. Second option, which Alex mentioned, is becoming an attractive option for most of the countries, but we will know in October, on 5th of October, when countries will discuss this in detail and then the resolution that they will negotiate afterwards. Second option is a framework convention international tax cooperation that will establish a common objectives and broad commitments, and of course, a conference of the parties regarding international tax cooperation, and then this general system of governance can be complemented by protocols on specific issues. And third option is a framework for international tax cooperation, which is non-binding, and it's an agenda for coordinated actions. And I can give you parallels. It looks like the first option is UN Convention Against Corruption. Second option is more like the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And third option is more like the Sendai Framework on Disaster Risk Reduction. I'm using these analogies to make it easier to understand by those who are not familiar with the UN jargon and processes. Next steps. For option one and two, next steps actually will involve actions at two stages. First, which should happen this year, the Assembly could establish a member state-led intergovernmental ad hoc expert advisory group to prepare the draft terms of reference for negotiating a convention. So how do you establish the functions of the parties and how do they come together to negotiate? And the second step will be to actually, after the TORs are agreed, to establish a member state-led intergovernmental ad hoc committee to negotiate the convention. And that's the practice we followed on UNCAC, the UN Convention, Anti-Corruption Convention. For the non-legally binding framework, which is the third option, the Assembly would establish a member state-led intergovernmental ad hoc group with a defined time frame. It has a deadline to end its work, and then a high-level subject matter conference with such a framework would be typically emerge from such a conference, and that has happened in the case of many other issues also. So with these three options, we have identified the next steps the member states can choose to take. And for the expert group, we don't require more than 12 months to come up with the details, the TORs. But then it requires, I think, longer time period once they decide to start negotiating the framework or other possibilities of coming up with a legally binding or non-legally binding, whatever they decide in terms of the form that legislation should take, that UN will bring. So after identifying these options, we have, of course, been briefing member states, and they are in the process of drafting a resolution which they will be presenting the week of 9th October after the debate on 5th of October. And we are here to support them, but I also will call on all experts and activists to continue to help member states in getting greater clarity. And what will be the most effective way to proceed to meet the two criteria that they have identified in the resolution? Let me end, Alex, by mentioning that once they agree on the option, they will need continuous support in their capacity to make sure that they negotiate these things in a manner that safeguards their interest, that secures their right to tax, And that also enables them to generate the resources they need to invest in sustainable development goals and in climate action. The United Nations, of course, will bolster its capacities even further to support member states in a very meaningful fashion and help them in shaping a regime which addresses the concerns that they have clearly identified in the resolution that they adopted last year. Let me stop here and once again thank you for the opportunity to join all of you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Navid, in greeting for your very kind words at the beginning. It's kind of fascinating to hear, and I think there's a set of questions that we'll get into, but we'll go around each of the speakers and then come back with that. I see that Dr. Maria Fernanda Valdez has joined us, the Deputy Minister of Finance of Colombia. Buenos días y muchas gracias por unirse con nosotros. It's a great honor for us to have you with us. I understand that your schedule is very busy, but you know, the chance to hear from the Colombian Ministry of Finance when you know, you've been leading this process of regional cooperation is too good for us to miss. So please let me hand straight over to you for your reflections on this process at the UN, but also the regional process that you're leading. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. So it's a pleasure to be with you today. I'm really happy to meet with former colleagues and friends and discuss the role of the Platform for Taxation in Latin America and the Caribbean, now known as PTLAC, in Spanish, PETELAC, and to talk about the role of Colombia in all the discussions that are happening in the OECD, but also in the UN. So I would like to start with some words about the PTLAC. As you may know, last July, 2 months ago, 14 countries of Latin America and the Caribbean met in Cartagena, India, to establish this platform, this PTLAC platform, a platform for regional coordination, which has four objectives. The first is to be a platform for sharing experiences and good practices. The second is to help countries build capacities. The third is to produce inputs that could benefit countries in staying informed and taking positions on current tax discussions in the international sphere. We all know here that developing countries do not have always the capacity to digest the large amount of information that comes from international negotiation. So this third objective was intended to close the gap. And the fourth is eventually, and this is the last aim of this space, is to create a unified regional stance on international taxation. And somehow to replicate what happens in other regions. We know what happens in Africa, for instance, that countries tend to go with unified positions on those discussions. We don't do the same in Latin America, and we really want this platform to be the start of unified positions for Latin America and the Caribbean. So during this meeting, during this summit, the PTLAC identified priority topics. It was the first decision that it made as a platform was to prioritize topics, four topics that we hope we can bring forward and position in international discussions as a region. So the first of the topics was progressivity. The second one was environmental taxation, then digital taxation and tax benefits. For each of those four topics, we have requested proposals from civil society and the private sector, so they can bring us the proposals before October 9th. Once we agree on the final proposals for one of those four issues, we hope to take them to discussions at the international stage, either at the OECD or at the UN. We also hope that through this platform, we can have a dialogue between Latin America and other countries of the global south on tax matters that could eventually lead to a unified position at the United Nations or at the OECD. So our idea is not only to, between us, among us, decide which is our position, but also we talk with other countries and other regions of the global south and to go with unified positions as well. So I would like now to talk about Colombia and what is the role of Colombia in all of the discussions that are happening at the moment. First, you also may know that Colombia is a country that is a member of both the OECD and the G27. And we believe that we can definitely lead and represent the Global South in those discussions, ensuring that the shared interests of our countries prevail. I have to say that we recognize the efforts and advances of the inclusive framework discussions at the OECD, but we also are conscious of all the limitations, and we believe that some of the decisions that are being made were not necessarily in the best interest of our countries. One of the reasons why this happened is that many developing countries, as I already said, do not have the capacity to discuss sometimes extremely technical issues on equal grounds. This is actually, as I said, one of the main objectives of PTLAC, to fill that information gap. Now, what is the position of Colombia related to what is happening in the UN? Colombia welcomes the recent report released by the UN last July. We definitely believe this is an important step towards a more equal, transparent, and inclusive international tax system. We are still in the process of analyzing all the options presented, the three options presented in the report, and we hope to arrive next month with a unified position, not only with the PTLAC country members. In that sense, as a country that is a member both of the OECD and the G27, we will continue to actively participate in the discussions being held at both stages, the OECD and the UN, with the aim of achieving the best possible outcomes for our countries. So let me finish emphasizing once again the important role of the civil society in those discussions. I know quite well, as a person who has been working on issues of tax justice in Latin America already for years, and we met in those discussions even 10 years ago. I know perfectly well how important organizations and the tax justice network has been in all what is happening in this moment. And for that reason, the government of Colombia is convinced that the active participation of civil society organizations in this process is a necessary condition for its success. This is why civil society organizations play a crucial role in the governance of the PTLAC. Once again, thank you for the invitation. I won't be able to stay for the question sessions. I have to attend another important meeting. They're already waiting for me, but I'm at your entire disposal to continue this discussion. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you making the time, and we look forward to the PTLAC decision on which option to back, which of course we all hope will be option two. But thank you, and I hope we will continue in touch. So,
thank you, Alex. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Let me hand over to Dr. Leo Latif, who, as I mentioned, is, among very many other things, one of our non-executive directors, and has been a key part in building the Committee for Fiscal Studies at the University of Nairobi, which is a key policy research hub for the region. And Leila, I know you've also been involved in a lot